From Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Today's programming is made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sports shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, as usual, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Let me just tell you about tomorrow on the program. In the 10 o'clock hour, we'll talk about the problem of the spread of nuclear weapons, and our guest will be Jim Walsh. He is Executive Director of Managing the Atom Project at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, which is part of the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Then in the second part of the show, a very different topic, we'll be talking about the life and times of one of America's greatest blues musicians, Howlin' Wolf. And our guest will be James Segrest, author of a recently published book titled Moanin' at Midnight, which is a biography of Howlin' Wolf. That'll be tomorrow in the 11 o'clock hour. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. Once a month on the program, we talk about women's health, and that is generally on a Monday in the 10 o'clock hour of the show, with, now for many years, the same guest, Dr. Suzanne Troopin. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist here with a practice in our area. She's also on the faculty of the med school here at the U of I, and she makes this regular visit to us once a month to talk about women's health. Now, as I say, usually that's a Monday show, and it's the 10 o'clock hour. Well, we've had to make a little change in the schedule this time around. Next Monday would have been the time for her to be here, but we couldn't do that, but we also didn't want to go an entire month without having her. So we have rearranged things. It is the different day and time, but essentially it's the same program that we have in mind. She usually comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new or that might be in the news. We will do that. And if people have questions on that, that's welcome. But of course, the idea here is that whatever is on your mind, as long as it falls in her area of practice, you can call. And I do like to try to remind people that when we have physicians on the program, and we do that on a pretty regular basis, that we can't do diagnosis over the telephone. If you have a particular concern, you need to take that up with a doctor that can see you. But we also, for a long time, have been doing shows here, regular programs on health, because we thought it offers people a place to start. Maybe ask some basic questions, add to their knowledge about health, and then take it from there with their own doctors. Questions are certainly welcome, and I know that the doctor will do her best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. Well, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Thank you. Good morning.
There are some particular things that you would like to talk about.
Well, sure. There are a lot of different interesting things in the news. I think a few months back, I talked about the new form of sterilization called the E-Sure procedure. Mm-hmm. And they're little micro inserts. They're actually coils that are inserted through the cervix through a procedure called hysteroscopy into the fallopian tubes to form a barrier that then granulates in. Essentially, fibrosis grows in, and the tubes then are blocked after about 3 months' time, and you need to get an X-ray to confirm that they are, in fact, blocked. And in the research studies, they were found to be 100% effective for sterilization purposes. We've only had a few cases that have been done in our area, in part because insurance hasn't really quite kicked in and picked up. The inserts themselves are quite expensive. So in order for a patient to have one of these procedures, her insurance would have to cover the technical component of the doctor inserting the device as well as the device. So that's led to some slowness in terms of implementing this technology can't always be done in every patient. If she already has a block in one fallopian tube or something like that, it can't always be done. But it has now been extended in terms of its effectiveness from 2 years up to 3 years, and they're quoting that it's 99.8% effective. Now, this is only 99.8% effective in the cases where both tubes do get the inserts, and you get the follow-up X-ray to be sure that your tubes have been completely blocked. And a lot of women are really liking the idea of the procedure because it isn't you don't have to be cut on. So mm-hmm. it's not an abdominal surgery in any way, shape, or form. And it actually can be done under local anesthesia in an office setting. And many patients do choose to have it under general anesthesia. And general anesthesia does relax those tubes and make the insertion a little bit easier in some cases. But I think that this is a method that you're going to hear a lot more about. But as you can see, it's very, very new. We're only extending the data out to 3 years, whereas, of course, tubal ligations have been around most of the 1900s, I think. Yeah. I think they definitely, before 1950s, they were doing tubal ligations. So it's definitely a good alternative for some women.
Okay. Well, we have a caller. Why don't we talk with them? In Champaign, I believe, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I am interested in knowing what Dr. Trupin knows about advanced stages of candidiasis. I have a history of candida infections, and I have now been diagnosed with high liver enzymes. I have a 53 when it needs to be a 39, an SGPT of 87, and that should be below 52. And I wonder if the years of candidiasis, the unbalance, I had read at least, and I'd like to see if doctors have any experience with this, that it can infect some of the major organs. I have the symptoms of a problem with my liver because I have a jaundice and fat in the in a real watery stool, and I eat only turkey because I have some other sensitivities and allergies, and it shows up more whenever I eat the dark meat, but I do get rid of all the fat. And so I'm able to trigger the jaundice by increased fat, and I'm able to lower the jaundice by getting it out of my diet. And hepatitis has been outruled. So I was wondering if she could give me any ideas whether this is an immune problem that is going, are the cells destroying themselves, or can she give me any ideas of what might be happening here?
Well, for listeners that may not be quite up on all the extensive medical research you've done into this condition, Candida albicans is a yeast organism. It's quite ubiquitous in our population. In fact, at any one time, we round up a group of women and do vaginal cultures. About 1 in 4 women will probably test positive for this organism or one of its cousin yeast organisms vaginally. And for women where the organism grows very rapidly and takes over in the vaginal flora, meaning all the different microorganisms in the normal healthy vagina, if you have an unbalance of the presence of the candida, it can become a candida vaginal infection. And these are quite common. In fact, they estimate that about 75% of all women have had a candida vaginal infection at some time, and they're commonly available over-the-counter products that treat these infections extremely well. Now, some people develop chronic vaginal infections, and we've begun to understand some of the factors that lead to chronic vaginal infections. And one of the common reasons to develop a chronic infection, in other words, where you treat it, it gets better, it comes right back, or you have to treat for weeks on end. And one of the causes, and there are several, and I know we've talked about this a little bit on other shows, but and I wouldn't be able to spend the whole hour on the subject, but carriage of these organisms in the GI tract, so especially in the lower colon, is actually fairly common in people that are essentially healthy. Same to just the condition thrush can be candidiasis of the mouth. And, of course, babies and children tend to get it a little bit more, but it's also known in adults and sometimes can be sort of sticky to treat. It turns out that we do know that some individuals who are extremely ill, for instance, individuals who not only carry HIV but are very immune compromised, apparently can get candidiasis, in other words, this infection of their entire system, and that could include organs. It's not something that a gynecologist like myself would ever really treat, and actually it's not something that I've ever had any of my patients have cases of. So that in a routine healthy population, it's not something that we see a lot, although I see a lot of the oral and the GI candidiasis. And we don't know. There was a popular book written that talked about people with these chronic vaginal yeast infections, and perhaps they had more disseminated infections than even in their GI tract, and that they needed evaluation and treatment. And that's probably, when you get to that stage, the correct type of physician that usually handles that level of case would be an infectious disease specialist, most likely. Some internists might handle cases like that, but probably an infectious disease specialist, and they would be able to know what kinds of tests to run and to be sure that the condition that you're reporting in your liver is related to any infection that you might have, because there are so many things that can lead to liver disorders. But that's about all I can tell you in a general basis, but I can't really offer you any specific guidelines about what tests you actually need or treatments, other than to get in with an infectious disease specialist.
Okay, let me ask you then, I know this is out of your area, but maybe you can help me simply because you are a doctor. In the liver itself, if I can trigger this jaundice effect, would you say that there could be some blockage in the liver that's causing the, if the gallbladder is releasing the bile, but it's not digesting the fats, could there be some blockage that would cause these slightly elevated enzyme levels? Would that be a possibility? And also, if the SGPT level is a little higher than normal, is that an indication that liver cells are being broken down abnormally? Can you answer either of those?
Well, basically, yes, there can be bile duct or some of the major ducts of the liver that are blocked, that are related to people having abnormal liver function tests like the SGOPT and so forth. It's also possible that they can be related to the degree of jaundice. They can be related to the degree of other symptoms like fatty stools. And diet can play a factor. Many other medications can play a factor. Exactly being able to give you a current up-to-date analysis of what cellular mechanisms are going on in your liver, I really probably haven't truly reviewed that information since medical school, so I think we're going to have to leave that to the internist.
Yeah, I think maybe we're about.
One more quick question: what test would show? What would be the best test to take to show blockage?
You know, I really think that if you see an internist and sit down and go over the types of tests that test for both liver function and biliary function, and in the context of both your symptoms and your past medical history, that's going to serve you the best. Yeah. But thank you for calling.
Yeah, I think that's probably about the extent that we can do here on this program. As I said in the beginning, it's kind of tough sometimes when you get into a detail, an individual's case
It is, and it's really not my field, unfortunately.
Okay. Well, our guest this morning, Dr. Suzanne Troopen, she is an obstetrician and a gynecologist, and once a month, usually on a Monday, she is here and we talk about women's health. We've changed the schedule a little bit this week, but the program, the idea about the program, behind the program is the same. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, if you have questions. We were talking a little bit right at the beginning about this new sterilization
yes.
method that involves essentially putting a device into the fallopian tube, then the tube essentially scars over and it blocks the tube.
Yes.
And effectively making it impossible for the sperm and the egg to get together.
Correct.
And you talked about the fact that some women might find the procedure appealing because it doesn't involve having to make an incision in the abdomen that you would do if you were going to do tubal ligation.
Correct.
I'm just curious for the majority of tubals, people who have them, are they cases where the woman is just going for that procedure, or are there how many cases are you doing something else, some other surgery, and you sort of say, well, while we're in there, tie my tubes.
Well, actually adding in little bits of elective surgery, there's been sort of a trend away from it. For instance, when I first started practice, it was very common to throw in an epidectomy at the same time we did a hysterectomy and so forth and so on. And we just don't do as much of that. It is true that if a woman has had endometriosis or pelvic pain and she's going to have a diagnostic surgery to see what's going on, and if she's also at that point in time where she might have been considering a tubal sterilization, that those two things could be combined. If somebody was having a miscarriage and they knew for sure they were not wanting more children, that could be combined, just like after a birth. We often do a tubal ligation, and often we will do a tubal ligation at the time of a cesarean section. So we do combine tubal ligations with other types of operations. You might be removing a cyst or something like that. And I think that still, tubal ligations have been extraordinarily popular. If you look at our population over the age of 35 and you take into consideration the males with vasectomies, the women with tubal ligations, and the couples that have sterilization or infertility, being sterile for some other kind of reason like a tubal factor or something like that, statistically, over one-third of the population over age 35 is using sterilization essentially as their contraception. So it's very popular. There's also hope that with the ESHER procedures that you avoid some potential risks, like avoiding the risk of anesthesia and avoiding the any complications of the instruments being introduced into the abdomen for the tubal ligation, although risks are very, very low. But the ESHER procedure probably isn't one that you're going to piggyback onto other procedures. Sometimes we do hysteroscopies for bleeding disorder, but in that case, you would probably want to evaluate what was going on medically before you make the decision about getting an ESHER implant. The other consideration for the implant is that it was 100% effective in the study, so there really haven't been any ongoing pregnancies. And basically, with a tubal ligation, you could either get your tubes reconnected, which isn't really done that much anymore, or you could have a test tube baby because nothing is actually done to your uterus at the time that the ESHER is placed. So there are some significant benefits, but it's very new. Very new.
Okay. We have another caller here. It's also someone in Champaign. Let's go there. Line number one. Hello.
Hi. Good morning. I have a silly question. Someone I know is having a baby, and this topic came up at lunch the other day. I know when the baby's in the uterus, the umbilical cord to them provides them, you know, nutrients and that. What happens after the baby's born and they clip the umbilical cord? What is that connected to inside? Like as a grown adult, inside your belly button, is there anything there?
There's a remnant, and it becomes this thing called a uracus, and it just looks like a string, like a collapsed sort of a string. But yeah, the connections to where the umbilical cord goes inside your abdomen, they essentially atrophy and go away. And really, there's, I think, a few rarer cases where something might persist. But, yeah, it just shrinks up and goes away.
And before that, it's just basically like veins and
carrying
back and forth.
Right. We have one big in the umbilical cord. Most of us have one big vein and two arteries, except they're different. Typically in our circulation, veins carry blood back to the heart and arteries carry blood away from the heart. So arteries usually have the more oxygenated blood. And in babies, it's reversed because of where it's coming from. And it's picking up the oxygen. And so it's a little bit reversed circulation-wise. But many babies have just one artery and one vein. And when that occurs, we do worry because statistically it's a little bit more likely for a developing infant to also have other birth defects if that's what we find. So we always look for them. But actually, periodically we do see that too.
Well, thank you, Mystery Solved.
All right. Thanks for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Just since the subject of umbilical cords comes up, I'm curious because I know that some months back, one of the things you talked about was cord blood, banking cord blood, and suggesting to people that now that's an option and it's also a good thing to do, to think about. Are more and more people doing that now?
Well, you know, it took off for a little while. There's been a law enacted in the state of Illinois where they're trying to get a state-run bank off the ground. And essentially, so many parents took advantage of contributing to that, their baby's cord blood to that bank that, I as far as I know, that the system's a little bit overwhelmed and almost on halt at the moment. And as soon as you were asking that question, I was thinking, haven't asked it when they're going to start that back up. But I think they'll get that up and going. More and more people are doing it individually. With the state-run program, I think you could opt for $1,000 to not have your baby go into the general pool of blood, but have your baby's blood specifically saved just for your own purposes. Mm-hmm. And there are many different banks out there that are very reputable, and two or three have easier collection devices, so I like them better. But over the past couple of years, I've worked with a number of different banks, and my patients have generally been very happy with it. And the big holdup is cost. But I think also in terms of the scientific merit, I think it's a great idea. The options for the kinds of things that you can do with cord blood may be expanding as we learn how to use other kinds of cells to provide those stem cells that they would be getting from the cord.
I don't remember specifically when we talked about this, but I thinking about it now, my guess would be that you wouldn't be talking about very much blood. How much blood
You can get an entire unit of blood.
Really?
Between the cord and the placenta.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I think that's 250 cc's, I think.
So it is a significant. If then later something should happen, it's like any time if people are thinking about having surgery, there's something that's happening where it's likely they might need blood. It's always better to get your own blood back than to get somebody else's blood. Is that?
Well, the word always goes a long way. Maybe your blood isn't as healthy as somebody else's blood for certain reasons. Generally, what we say, of course, banking a cord blood is a little bit different than banking an adult's blood. Mm-hmm. Adult blood is usually banked electively for, say, planned surgeries, that sort of thing. And it's kind of weird. And there was a big push for that about, oh gosh, it's been 10 or 15 years ago. And now there, at least in my field, there's been a big swing away from banking electively blood before surgeries. And the reasoning is kind of like this. The incidence of transfusion from most of the major gynecologic operations that go on a day-to-day basis, like a hysterectomy, your chance of needing a transfusion is somewhere between 1 and 3% if you were completely healthy. And even certain medical factors might only drive that up a few percentile points. So you're banking a lot of patients' blood for not very many patients that need that blood back. But when you take the blood, you're going to make your patient a little bit relatively more anemic. So you're going to create a situation where actually more people need transfusions post-surgery because you start at a lower point. And once that blood leaves your body, it is possible for medical errors to occur. When you get that back, it's just red blood in a bag, and you have to trust that that bag was labeled correctly and so forth and so on. And so probably for most patients having elective surgery, there's really no need to bank your own blood. There's good, healthy blood available for you should you ever need it. Now, if a particular patient has very odd blood, a very rare type, or some sort of odd antibody situations, then it may be better, in fact, to bank your own blood. There's also quite a bit of interest in other products that can do what a blood transfusion would do. Of course, there are people that do not accept blood transfusions, so we've been trying some of these strategies for many, many years in that patient population, and many, many patients have been treated very, very safely and effectively. But new formulations for intravenous iron are possible blood substitutes. There's essentially a kidney hormone that our body makes, erythropoietin, and that can be used to stimulate our own blood cells to be produced. So possibly even in some cases, if you're anemic going into a surgery, there can be things done. I know after delivery is a time when patients lose blood. And there is about a half again expansion of the blood volume of a pregnant mom. So instead of becoming anemic after you deliver, what happens to the mom is she gets back more to what her own blood volume would have been prior to her becoming pregnant. So we're sort of set up that way to lose about that amount of blood or less. Now, in cases where moms go into the delivery process a little bit anemic to begin with for one reason or another, then they're a little bit more likely to need a transfusion. So particularly with some patients who might have a planned surgery or a known specific type of complication where we're worried about blood loss, actually banking a pregnant mom's blood can be quite safe and has been done. I believe in using more of the blood substitutes, if at all possible. And I'm actually going to be involved in a research study looking at a new formulation of iron to treat pregnant anemic moms or postpartum anemic moms. So there's a lot of actual good research going on in that field right now.
Okay. Well, we have about, we're a little bit past our midpoint here. Certainly have time for other questions. Our guest is Dr. Suzanne Troopen. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. Once a month, she is on this program to talk about women's health. That's usually a Monday. In fact, it's usually the fourth Monday of the month. So we're doing a little change in the schedule this time around. But it's the same program. So if you have questions, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. There's some other topics you'd like to talk about?
Well, I always like to follow all the research on soy supplementation, particularly being the state of Illinois and being so close to industry that produces and promotes the healthy incorporation of soy into our diets. And a lot of women have now turned to soy supplementation as they get away from estrogen use or decrease their estrogen use. And I know in the past we've talked about whether or not soy supplementation can be enough to preserve your bone density. And there have been some issues. There were some researchers here at the University of Illinois that questioned whether or not the plant estrogens in soy might actually stimulate breast cancer growth rather than inhibit it just because they are these compounds are very estrogen-like. So there was a little bit of hesitation in building up your soy consumption very much. There's always been a, from that standpoint, there's always been a lot of interest in using soy to improve your lipid profile, so better cholesterol levels and that sort of thing have pretty much been confirmed by additional research. Again, some of this research going on here at the University of Illinois. And now some researchers, and off the top of my head, I don't remember exactly who did this study. I'm thinking that it may have been out of the country. But now some researchers were specifically looking at the effects of high levels of soy on the lining of the uterus, which we know one of the concerns we always had about patients taking estrogen hormone in menopause would be what the effects would be on the lining of the uterus. And that's why we came up with combination hormone replacement therapy where we used estrogen plus progesterone to avoid these hyperplasia effects on the uterus. And we worry that if a woman were to take estrogen alone and she still had a uterus, that it might increase her risk of lining cancer of the uterus if she did that for years on end. Short-term use apparently is pretty safe for pretty much anything. And now some researchers have looked at relatively higher doses of soy and found that, in fact, soy can also produce some of these lining thicknesses that we see with estrogen alone. So it's one study. It's an early study. I certainly wouldn't tell patients to stop soy intake, but I think that it's one of those pieces of health information that would be good to discuss with your physician if you're really remarkably increasing your soy intake.
Yeah. Well, I think when we've talked about this in the past, and there have been some questions from women who are interested in the possibility that rather than using doing a kind of a hormonal replacement therapy,
right,
that they like the idea of something that would be not using a medicine, but using something that would be more natural. And the question is, well, can I get enough plant-based estrogen to actually achieve the kind of effect that you can if you're taking the medicine, if you're supplementing it that way? And as I recall, you seem to be saying, well, we're not really sure that you can eat that much
there are a couple of different issues. There are actual pills you can buy that have some of the estrogen extract. And so the question is that extract really the key ingredient, and would that be enough? And also exactly what the levels can be, because in general, if we look at plant estrogens compared to other estrogens, plant estrogens are significantly weaker. So that would speak to whether or not you can eat enough. And also our diet sensibilities are different. And if we look, for instance, in, say, a Japanese culture that has a lot of soy intake, one thing we have to remember is these individuals had high soy intake from childhood on. So they had high soy intake through puberty and through their reproductive years. And whether or not then you can, at the age of menopause, suddenly mimic their health benefits from soy by newly doing soy has been brought into question, aside from the fact that it might not be the kind of diet that you're used to or have access to. But if it's enough estrogen-like to help your hot flashes, it might be enough estrogen-like to cause some of the side effects that led these women to stop estrogen to begin with. So one of the flaws with menopausal health research has been that we spent all these years studying how to best get women on hormones, what dose, what type, and it's just a very new concept to try to encourage women to get off the hormones, or once they have stopped the hormones, what rational strategy do we have to help monitor the patient and know when we need to intervene with other kinds of strategy, like things for your bones and so forth.
Okay, we have some other callers here. Let's talk with someone in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, I'm just wondering what the doctor might be recommending these days in terms of vegetarian or flexitarian or pescatarian diets. There's been like a low-carb craze, and people are being told to, they're not being told exactly to eat more meat, but that's usually the response. because they're being told to reduce their simple sugars in their diets. So you were just talking about soy. Do you think that still a high complex carbohydrate diet with legumes like beans and soy and nuts and that kind of thing are still a very positive thing for the benefits for the health?
Well, my personal philosophy is that I've always, for years now, have always thought that a varied diet is important, and that there are probably a lot of micronutrients that a varied that you can get from food that you can't do otherwise. But one of the problems is this obesity situation that we're all faced with, and there's kind of two issues here that I think you're touching on, and one is. Can you be Atkins-like and vegetarian? I'm not sure, and that's a big question. And the other is one type of dietary approach better than others? In terms of maintaining weight versus, say, the person that's obese and needs to lose weight. So really, unfortunately, those are big, different kinds of questions. And I think in a nutshell, a little corny there. I think that we don't have enough research yet. There was a big study that was just out in the New England Journal of Medicine that for obese patients comparing the high protein to or low carb diet to a more regular type of diet. And one of the problems with that study is so many people dropped out. So, you know, a lot of us don't really follow things so specifically. So that's a problem in even answering the question, but it looked like in the first 6 months that the high protein patients did lose more weight. And I didn't read that study close enough to be able to tell you whether there were vegetarians in it, but I don't think there were. But by the end of 12 months, both groups were about the same. And as I understand it, there are going to be some bigger trials at the NIH. I know there's a website called clinicaltrials.gov that you can even look up a lot of industry trials, although periodically I try to look up trials I'm involved in. They haven't yet gotten uploaded to that site, but there are a lot of different trials listed there. And I think they're going to try to answer some of these questions. I think on an individual basis, what I usually recommend is to have a brief conversation, at least with your healthcare provider. Hopefully your primary care provider will know a little bit about nutritional background, and talk about what kinds of things you're doing and what kinds of micronutrients that you may or may not be getting because of some of the decisions you're making on your food choices, whether it be for, you know, social reasons or taste reasons or whatever it is, and try to do some research and see how you can maybe vary your diet enough to come up with all the nutrients. And then basically, what's your health? How's your energy level? How are you sleeping? And I talked to a caller very early in the show with liver issues. And, you know, there are some blood chemistries that can be drawn to make sure that you have, say, a normal calcium level in your diet and that sort of thing. So you're asking a great question. I'm not answering it at all.
Well, I've always been more or less, you know, a flexitarian. I haven't really been a big meat eater in my life, more of a vegetarian diet. But when I started in the 70s, you know, people were concerned about how can you get enough protein on a vegetarian diet. But now I meet young people, and they seem to think, well, you can get enough protein just eating anything. So it seems to me that if vegetarians probably do need to be concerned about getting a fairly high level of protein, but they wouldn't necessarily have to eat meat or very much. So I guess that was my concern, or just that I was wondering, I always was under the impression that vegetarians had less likelihood of having diabetes and heart disease, or at least heart disease. So it seems like that's what they're so concerned about with, you know, this outbreak of obesity. So,
well, I think that if you are the type of vegetarian that eats enough of a balance where your energy levels are stable, in other words, you're not taking in so many more calories than you're burning up, then I think you're in good shape. But I think we've shown that obesity is linked to diabetes and heart disease. And if you're a vegetarian with a very high, say, for instance, cheese intake, you are going to potentially be in a heart health risk if you gain weight, if you are modest about it, and if your cholesterol levels maintain in a low range and you're thin and you exercise, you're probably in the low risk category for heart disease.
Yeah, and that always comes back to the question of balance, because I was just reading that if you don't get enough calcium, or at least if young girls or young people don't get enough calcium, or they don't eat enough milk or cheese or whatever, they are more prone to obesity. So it's always like, don't get too much, don't get too little.
Well, and there are a lot of these questions that we haven't answered, and I was reading something about bottled water and how the fact of so much bottled water isn't fluoridated. And I guess there's a website where you can look that up, too.
And so,
you know, things where maybe have crept in our society, taking it for granted, we can't necessarily.
Yeah, and then I don't know if you can answer this question. There are certain medications that say that they could possibly increase your prolactin levels, and then
many.
Right, and then they may say, well, if you have breast cancer, if you've had breast cancer, you shouldn't take this medication. But I'm just wondering if you've had breast cancer in the family, whether you should question using such a medication.
I haven't seen anything written about that.
Mm-hmm.
There may be. Nothing that sticks in my mind, but I think if you had a question, prolactin's an easy blood test.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Let's continue. And the next caller is in Urbana on line number 2. Hello.
Hi. I'm going back to the soy in the in diets and its relationship to estrogen. When you say significant amounts of soy products, you know, what are you talking about?
Well, in I think in Japanese and Asian, they get about, is it 200? I'm thinking milligrams or grams. I don't remember all the different levels. One of the problems is in most of the studies, they pick all these different random levels, and there's not any really known standardization, but it would probably be like getting your diet up to Asian levels of soy intake, and then possibly even on top of that, using supplements. And again, that particular piece of research that I was quoting, it's a new study. And just one more piece that we're looking at. And I don't know that I think if people are moderate. So, you know, if you have a little tofu in your diet and you have some miso soup and you eat soy nuts now and then, I think you're going to be fine. But if you're suddenly trying to incorporate this almost into three meals a day, I think that might get you up to Asian levels.
Okay, thank you.
All right, let's continue. And we'll go here to line number 4. And the caller here is in Indiana. Hello.
Hello. I've listened to you throughout the last few years. I have a number of girls in the extended family, so to speak, and most of them are young, 20 to 29. And their attitude towards doctors is very flippant. And so I listen to you rather well and pass on information and try to use whatever power I have to get them to take care of themselves. The question now I would like to ask is perhaps too general, but what is the safe extra percentage of weight a young girl or an older woman, as far as that goes, can carry without, in a sense, diabetes, heart problems, you know, just in the general sense, would pop up on the screen? One woman is 5'4", and has decided that she's going to take it easy for a while in terms of, you know, keeping a slim body and all that, and she says she's going to be like the rest of the ladies in her age class, and most of them are overweight. And I just have started a campaign, very subtle, but trying to get her to lose some weight. And if I had some facts about, well, you're, you know, 17% over, and that means blah, 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 can you give me any information like that?
There's a tremendous amount of good information about that. And right now, the best formula that we have to use is the BMI. And it's a basal metabolic index. And it's basically your height over your weight. And we categorize people from, I think it's like 18.9. So essentially 19 to 25 is considered normal weight. 25 to 29 is considered overweight. And then the next grouping for obese is 30 to 40, and then it gets to, I think it's very super obese and severely obese. Like, I don't remember all the different terms. And there are all kinds of places you can go on the web. I know that eMedicine.com has a consumer health area, and then you can go under tools and you can put in your BMI. You can also, they have a great tool where you can put in your age and your weight relative to your sex. I can't remember I think you must put your height in there.
Do they consider body frame, you know, large bone, small bone, that sort of thing? That's unfortunately, you know, I mean, I haven't had much, you know, and I've always explained to myself, you are small boned. You do not. You're not a 100-yard athlete in the Olympics.
I think that if you actually put, I mean, what you're saying is absolutely right. But we're talking for the whole population.
Yeah.
And then if you go even into like the American Heart Association website and the American Diabetes website, those things then talk about for your BMI what risks you have, and truly, what's best for all of us is to be in the normal weight range, 19 to 25.
19.
I think if you're young and you exercise and you are in the 25 to 30 range, 25, 29, you know, just under the obese, you're in reasonably good shape.
Okay. Now, the BMI, now that the immediate thing that came to my mind is people walking on treads with a mask over their mouth and nose.
This is a formula. They've got actual tables.
Okay.
It's just based. It's
you
a simple.
You could go on to Medscape or WebMD. You can find. Just put BMI on under Google. You'll probably find tons. Right.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks.
Appreciate
and that is it. It's based. It's
in books too.
It's a simple calculation that's just based on your height and your weight.
Correct.
Is that right? But you do have to do some conversion of the things.
Right.
But basically, what it is, it takes your height, it takes your weight, it comes up with a number.
And the original BMI was height and weight, whether you're male or female. But now energy expenditure and some of the actual risks of heart disease and diabetes are, of course, then linked to your age and your sex.
Okay. West Lafayette, next, line one. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Trubin. I would like to ask what the latest idea is for management of whether, I'm not sure which it is, cystocele, rectocele, or uterine prolapse. It's just a little problem creeping up on me as I age.
Well, once uterine prolapse becomes severe, there's basically nothing you can do other than having surgery. In the mild to moderate stages, you can use a pessary, which is a rubber device which kind of holds everything in. And with cystoceles and rectoceles, again, in the mild stages, we usually recommend Kegels exercises, which are a tightening exercise. But once they get to the severe stage, they really can only be repaired surgically. There are a lot of innovations in the surgery for these kinds of conditions, particularly with incontinence, with these mesh slings that are used that are able to be placed very rapidly in a relatively minor operation compared to what we used to do. And also there are some slings to correct some of the prolapses of that pelvic diaphragm, which lead to the cystocele and rectocele. But it's unfortunately one of those things where you got to sit down with your physician and you have to find out what your anatomy is really showing, what degree, and where you might be on that whole continuum of exercise and weight versus surgery.
Okay. I was hoping there was something really new and really easy. Thank you very much.
All right. On to another caller here, Chicago, line two. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to give a reference for that gentleman who was calling about his relatives. I think the best book available is Paul Campos, The Obesity Myth, because, you know, he brings into question the BMI because exactly for the point that gentleman mentioned, the bone size of the body, and also now they seem to think that weight gain might be related a great deal to genetics, which would predispose some people to a certain size. And I think the main point was that they're not really sure what is healthy at what weight. It's very individual, and that the BMI is probably too gross a measure to be applied as it is.
Well, in those kinds of books, and what you're saying has some grain of truth, and absolutely, you need to take your whole health picture, your whole genetic picture. But the the fact of the matter is that probably only 5 to 10% of the population was obese. If you use any kind of cutoff, the overall population weight gain is massively increasing, in that we now have segments of our population that over half of some parts of our population have obese adults. And with that, we have skyrocketing rates of heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, stroke, gallbladder disease. We've linked breast cancer to obesity. We've linked other cancers to obesity. And you're right in that there may not be this absolute, you must be 152 versus 153 pounds and so forth and so on, or 150 versus 160. But there's no doubt about it, in certain ranges, that almost universally all the research shows that's too much.
Well, he's called that into question, and the primary reason that he's called it into question is that they really, in most of those studies, they haven't linked in other factors, and that begins to make a problem, that what you really need to look at is a person's exercise history and the type of food that they eat, and that those two factors are greater factors than the actual weight of the person. You know, like the sumi wrestlers who are tremendously huge but in fact have a great deal of muscle tone. So I think my main concern is that he's talking about young women, and I think you probably know from your practice the danger with young women are having false ideas of how thin they should be.
Oh, there's definitely some of that.
And therefore driving themselves into gaining too much subcutaneous fat, which is difficult to lose, and then all the health problems related to yo-yo dieting. So I think that
actually, yo-yo dieting hasn't been shown to be the bad thing we thought of it before, interestingly.
Well, I've got to jump in here, and my apologies to the caller. We're at the end of the time, and we're going to have to stop. I'm sure that on other days we'll get back to some of these issues. You can also look for the regular monthly show that they do on the Afternoon Magazine once a month, dealing specifically with nutrition issues. We can do with that and that kind of context, too. But for right now, we're going to have to say thank you very much, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.
To our guest, Dr. Suzanne Truppen. She's an obstetrician and a gynecologist. She has a practice here in our area, and also she teaches at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. Well, today's broadcast is made possible with support from World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods, imported foods from around the world, including imported chocolates, cookies, coffee, extra virgin olive oil, and featuring a selection of new cheeses every week. World Harvest Foods, at the intersection of 6th and University in Champaign, encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned, though, because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk with writer and naturalist Gary Ferguson. His latest book is about the Rocky Mountains, The Great Divide, The Rocky Mountains in the American Mind. We'll talk with Gary Ferguson today following the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat, 330 and three quarters, down 4 3/4. December wheat, 343 and three quarters, down 4 1/4. September corn, 233 and a quarter, down 3 3/4. December corn, 241 and a half, down 3 1/2. March, 249 and a half, down 3 1/4. May corn, 255 and a half, down 3 1/2. August beans, 7.13, that's up 5 1/2.